Tracking COVID numbers, Latin America becomes the new epicenter of the pandemic, and the return of drive-in movies. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Florida is trying to reopen its economy, and the governor and other leaders are using a metric called positivity rates to determine which areas can reopen faster than others. Brazil now has the second most COVID-19 cases next to the U.S. Mexico numbers are rapidly climbing. We're going to look at how the virus is spreading in Central and South America just as those economies try to reopen. We'll also look at how the younger generation of Latinos are trying to bring relief to their home countries. And finally, movie theaters are still not open in South Florida, except for drive-in theaters. Has the pandemic reshaped the way we find entertainment? Will it bring back the drive-in experience? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. South Florida continues slowly reopening to public life. Gyms reopen in Miami-Dade on Monday, and beaches in Miami are going to reopen tomorrow. The rest of the state entered phase two of Governor DeSantis' reopening last week, and that includes bars, movie theaters, and bowling alleys. They are allowed at limited capacity. Now, one of the key data points that the governor and county leaders have been using to justify reopening is called the COVID positivity rate. Veronica Zaragovia is WLRN's new healthcare reporter, and she joins us now to help us understand that. Veronica, welcome to the program.
Hi, Luis. Thank you so much.
All right. So help us understand the significance of the numbers that the state has been following. What exactly is the positivity rate mean?
Sure. The positivity rate is the number of tests that were given in one day divided by how many people tested positive in that day. And when the positivity rate would be too high, then that might indicate that the state is only testing really sick patients. But in Florida's case, Florida has a positivity rate today. The health department has it at 5.2%, and around 5% is considered by the World Health Organization to be the upper limit for lifting restrictions. And what a low positivity rate like Florida's might indicate is that the state is doing sufficient testing for the size of the outbreak. And now, there are so many caveats that we can get into. So this is not just to say that everything's going perfectly in Florida, but it is one of the states with a better positivity rate.
So why has the positivity rate been the key metric, though, for so many lawmakers to justify reopening the way they have?
I think that they're looking at it as a way to indicate that the state is doing a good enough amount of testing if the rate is, and showing that the percentage of people who are testing positive is not, is at a point, let's say, where it might be safe to continue with reopening. But there are a lot of things that public health experts tell me is not clear in the data. For instance, it's not clear if who they're testing is a person, an inmate in a prison, or a person who lives in a assisted living facility, for instance. This is considered a high risk population, how many of these are people who are going about their daily life and they're driving up to a testing site or getting tested outside of a Publix or a Home Depot that has recently been offered. And so I think that I'm going to be totally honest that there's a lot we don't know. And I think that's what's really important in reporting about this pandemic, that we have to monitor these numbers every day, but that there are some uncertainties that we don't have, some information that we don't have.
And it's interesting, as you point out, is that because we don't know when these test numbers come out, we don't know who these people are. And as you said, it could be, for example, within the prison population, where we've seen massive growth, massive expansion of the virus within the prison system or in assisted living facilities. What are the other key metrics, though, that public experts are following? Again, in deciding how to reopen the economy?
Right, and just to a quick point on what you just said, that when it's in a high risk population, then they can contain those cases. But if it's in the general population, then that's when it's really important to where the contact tracing comes in, because then these are the individuals who are contacting those people who tested positive, to find out who else were they in contact with, so that those people can isolate at home and not continue to spread the virus that causes the COVID-19 disease. And they are also looking, there is a difference between people who tested positive for the first time that day versus people who tested multiple times positive, let's say at a hospital, until they test negative and they can be discharged. And there are, those are two separate ones. So in order to gauge whether it's safe to reopen, public health experts are looking at the people who tested positive for the first time. And they're also looking at hospitalization rates. That's really important. If those are going up and these are people in who are in dire need of care, then there would it wouldn't be as safe to go about reopening.
And
And
the other thing too, I wondered is this, because they're talking about they've been talking about reopening for the last month, and then we all of a sudden get the protests, and I wonder what are healthcare officials saying about these large congregations of protesters and the possible continued spread of the virus.
absolutely, they would say that this is unfortunately a way that the disease that the that COVID-19 will spread. I have seen reports that in some cities that people are wearing their masks, but it's people are in a close proximity, they're yelling, and so the saliva can spread maybe at a with more force. And what I all of the public health experts that I spoke to are saying that even in Florida, where we have this relatively low positivity rate, that this is not the time to feel comfortable enough to stop wearing your mask out in public. You have to continue to wash your hands, do not touch your face, and to really keep that distance between people. So they're also worried about hurricane season coming up, and this is a time when people tend to maybe seek shelter with other people. And so I don't think I've spoken to anyone that doubts there will be a second wave coming in the fall.
Yes, and again, it's hard to do social distancing when you have all of these people who are marching in the streets. Again, I'm talking with Veronica Zaragovia. She's WLRN's new healthcare reporter. Veronica grew up in Miami and has reported all over the globe, and you can find her stories for WLRN and also pitch her ideas. Just go to WLRN.org. Veronica, you recently did a story about the state's COVID-19 isolation centers. What are these? What are these? What's the function of one of these facilities?
Well, that's what caught my attention. I had never heard that term used before. And Governor DeSantis recently mentioned these centers in a press conference. They were opened up or chosen in May. And the state of Florida has five so far spread out throughout the state. And we have one in our region in South Florida, in Lauderhill. And these are already places where people live, let's say like nursing home or long-term assisted living facilities, where people have tested positive, and they're using a wing or a unit or sometimes the entire facility to bring people who live in assisted facilities or those types of institutions, and they are discharged from a hospital, but it's not safe yet for them to return to where they normally live. Perhaps because of the fear of contagion, that they can still be contagious.
And
And so,
so the place that's in Lauderhill is the Inspire Healthcare facility, right?
correct.
Why did they choose that place?
That is what has sparked a lot of concern from officials in Lauderhill, because there have been concerns about the transparency that center that Inspire has given family members of relatives of people who live in this facility. They say that the numbers of deaths and positive cases reported to the state and what they've told family members has differed. And the mayor of Lauderhill, Ken Thurston, told me that he's worried that the state is giving dollars, state dollars, to a center that really hasn't given them confidence in their ability to handle this disease. Apparently, the National Guard had gone in May to help. So they don't understand why it was chosen. They voted against this Inspire center having been chosen. And so we're kind of seeing what happens next in terms of the state providing answers.
This is a story, obviously, we're going to keep our eyes on. Thank you for bringing it to our attention. I wanted to turn the attention to you now because, again, you are our new healthcare reporter, but you're not new to Miami. I mean, you grew up here. So, but just a little bit about your background. It was, I think, 2018, you won a grant from the Pulitzer Center for reporting on the Colombian peace deal with the left-wing FARC guerrilla group. How did you find yourself working on that story?
Well, thank you so much for mentioning it. I applied with a friend who lives in Bogota, and she knew that because I was born there, that it would have been of great interest for both of us to collaborate on stories. And they had a proposal, the Pulitzer Center. They wanted applicants to suggest ideas related to war and peace. And so we wanted to follow up on this massive deal that was signed in 2016, and so by 2018 to see how the implementation was going. Unfortunately, it's been a pretty rocky process, and but that was a really life-changing experience for me to go there and interview guerrillas as much as I was interviewing people who were affected by the war.
You've reported a lot on these protests against the Colombian government over its use of violence against rebel organizations. What are the similarities that you're now seeing in the way the tactics of U.S. police compared to what you saw in Colombia?
Well, when I was there, it was already a time of peace, so I was relying a lot on what historians and witnesses were telling me. There's always a concern about transparency, and I think that was that's one of the frustrations that I think in both that happens in both countries, be it Colombia and the U.S., in terms of numbers, in terms of tactics, in terms of what are the directives that are given by officials in terms of how they keep peace or how they patrol people. But I would say that both societies are extremely vocal, and Colombia's population, especially the youth, and that's the same thing we're seeing now, have been very, very vocal and out in the streets protesting. Colombia's youth had gone out to protest in favor of the peace treaty. And so those are some of the similarities and just the people really wanting to seek justice.
As I mentioned, this is you're coming back home. You grew up in South Florida, but you were in Germany for a while, and you've traveled. And by the way, just as a note, you and I have worked together before when we were working at KNPR in Las Vegas. So somehow we keep finding each other. But I wondered, your experiences in Germany, your experiences working around covering Latin American stories, how all that brings you back to South Florida, and how that's going to influence the way you work here.
I would say that one of the main things I've learned over the course of my travels and reporting is to have empathy and to be able to listen to someone telling me their story. For me, I consider it a privilege. And so when someone opens up to me, regardless of whether they were a former guerrilla with the FARC or whether they're an official who believed in something that is very controversial, that it's my duty to listen and to help listeners understand that perspective. And also just the time I've spent abroad seeking story ideas and connecting with people, I think will help me very much here in South Florida, although this is home, and so it's a whole different level of empathy because this is it affect it I care so very deeply about South Florida. My family lives here. I grew up here. This is the region that opened up its arms to us when we moved here from Colombia. So I'm especially excited and grateful to be here now.
And just to mention, too, by the way, you speak five languages, right?
Yes, I do.
Okay, wait, is it English, Spanish, what, German?
French, German, and Hebrew.
Okay. Here I am just trying to get my second language, Spanish, which I should be speaking fluently, and I still don't have that. Veronica, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Great to have you on the team.
Oh, thank you so much, Luis. We'll chat in Spanish next time.
Oh, all right, great, fantastic. I'll be ready.
Okay, great.
All right, that again is WLRN's new healthcare reporter, Veronica Zaragovi. And again, if you have story ideas for her, or if you want to read more about her work, you can find her at WLRN.org. You can email her, vzaragovia@WLRNnews.org. Well, still to come, Latin America is now the epicenter of COVID. Which countries are doing better than others, though? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Brazil has become the new epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak, with the second largest number of cases around the globe. Their numbers, by the way, are likely undercounted. On Saturday, the country stopped publishing the number of coronavirus cases and deaths after facing sharp criticism. How the pandemic is impacting Latin America differs greatly from country to country based on the country's political leadership and response. WLRN's Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett has been following this story closely. He joins us now. Tim, I hope you're being safe, man.
I am extremely safe. I mean, when you're my age, you have to take a lot of safe precautions.
Oh, well, I miss having you around, but it's great talking to you. All right, so let's get
you
into
too.
This. There's so much going on here. The increases in cases and deaths. Worse now in Latin America than any other part of the world. The WHO worried about governments reopening too fast. But how did Central and South America become the epicenter now?
Well, if you consider that what we're in right now, what scientists are calling a second wave of the pandemic, the first wave being sort of that first, February, March, April, Asia and China, Italy and Europe, the United States, sort of the northern tier of the world, sort of facing the first onslaught of this. Now it's more the southern part of the world that scientists see getting the brunt of this. And Latin America has just had a lot of factors that have come together to make it, as you just said, the epicenter of what, as I said, scientists are calling the second wave of the pandemic now.
There are three countries that have seen the greatest increase. Let's start with the one that I mentioned earlier, Brazil.
Right.
They have created a dangerous situation. They're not even providing accurate figures on infections or fatalities. What is going on there?
Well, you have a very populist demagogue, unfortunately, as president, who does not want to acknowledge that this pandemic even exists, unfortunately. He's dismissed it as a media hoax. And he has done, frankly, everything in his power to undermine the kind of social distancing, quarantine, lockdown, stay-at-home measures that every Brazilian scientist and doctor has been urging the federal government to do.
Is he still? He's also still just going out. I mean, I see photos and videos of him just going out and shaking people's hands, and he's not wearing any mask or any protection.
Sometimes he wears a mask. Often he doesn't. He wants to show that he doesn't fear this virus. He's very much in the strongman mold, the Caudillo mold of Latin American leaders, and he just doesn't want to acknowledge that this virus has taken a hold of his country and that he has to confront it in a way that might hurt the economy and therefore perhaps his chances of re-election in 2 years.
What did they do in the website again with the figures? Because now they're only posting like the most recent figures. They're not even tracking the entirety of this.
Right. All they're showing you is maybe what might be the most recent figures over a 24-hour period, but it doesn't really give you the scope. And what Bolsonaro, the reason that he said he's ordered his health minister to take this measure is because he claims that the state governors and local mayors around Brazil are inflating their reported numbers of cases and deaths as a way of getting back at him, which really doesn't hold any water either, because most scientists are telling us from Brazil that if anything, the reported number of cases and deaths from coronavirus in Brazil is vastly undercounted and may even be closer to the kinds of numbers we're seeing here in the United States.
How is he explaining away all of these deaths?
That's the unfortunate thing. I mean, as you and I have discussed before, Lewis, I mean, it was just a few weeks ago when he was confronted at a press conference in Brasilia about the deaths. And I'm not making this up. Verbatim, his response was, so what? He has really just sort of taken on the attitude that, okay, this virus is going to kill some people in my country, but it's just not worth eroding our economic performance the way we've seen it do in other countries. And therefore, he is not going to encourage any of the measures that we've taken for granted, for example, the United States. And in the process, he's blown through two or three health ministers who have either resigned or been fired by him for criticizing him for sending Brazilians just the utterly wrong message about how to confront this virus.
So we go from Brazil, let's go to Mexico. This is another country. They had one of their worst weeks when it comes to the number of deaths to COVID. Right. They're in the process of reopening, but there's an issue with the message that's coming from the president and from health officials. What's the problem there?
Right. So from Brazil, we go from a right-wing populist demagogue to Mexico, where we have a left-wing populist demagogue in power who, like Bolsonaro, is a sort of, you know, in the Caudillo strongman mold and doesn't like to acknowledge things that he can't control, i.e. coronavirus. And therefore, he, like Bolsonaro, has not done a very good job of getting his country to confront this virus with things like quarantine and lockdown as well. And now Mexico is starting to see the results of that sort of not as bad a dismissal as we've seen with Bolsonaro, but nonetheless, In many cases, a dismissal. I mean, he himself has a history in the past few months of going out and encouraging massive get-togethers of people that cause community transmission, and that's why we're seeing the deaths in Mexico now are number three in Latin America and the Caribbean, and the number of infections.
Yeah, and then another country with high rates is Peru, but they are doing more testing. One thing that I was curious about is Uruguay. They have very few cases, very few deaths. How's that possible?
Well, two factors that I point to, both with Uruguay and with Costa Rica. One is they've been aggressive about getting people to stay at home and to follow quarantine and lockdown measures. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that Uruguay and Costa Rica have a culture of public health care. And so people take these things seriously when their leaders tell them to do it. And another big factor is that Uruguay and Costa Rica are two of the countries in Latin America that have the lowest percentage of their workforce working in what we call the informal economy, that underground informal economy that you see every day in Latin America, where people are selling the iPhone earbuds on the streets or cooking the empanadas on the sidewalks. They live day to day, and they can't afford to stay inside during this pandemic because they have to survive. And as a result, because you have so many fewer people working in the informal economy in Uruguay and Costa Rica, and they have more of a social safety net in those countries, you don't see those economic pressures pushing people out into the streets to create more community transmission of this virus.
You know, one other country I did want to ask you about, too, my parents live in Colombia. As you know, I'm half Colombian. They now are actually getting, it's interesting, they had 2 days out of the week where they can, because they live in Medellin, 2 days out of the week where they can go outside. They're getting a third starting this week. They're starting to reopen. They had a pretty robust response to this.
They did. And they have been one of the countries that that hasn't been hit as hard as, say, Brazil or Mexico or Peru. And as you notice, that they are just now beginning to ease up on that. And we'll see if that turns out well in terms of whether we see another spike in cases for them. But Colombia is another country that was hit very hard economically because of this, because they, too, have so many people working in the informal economy. And those people have been suffering a lot because they have been able to find no other way to get income.
Luckily for my parents, they are retired, so they don't have to worry about that. But they have told me about a lot of the things they've seen, and it is kind of sad to to think about the people struggling. Again, talking with WLRN's America's correspondent Tim Padgett, looking at the impacts of COVID in Latin America, why Mexico and South America now seeing so many cases. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can always find us on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. If you have family back in the Caribbean, in Latin America, tell us what's going on, what you see, what your family is dealing with. I want to switch topics. Your recent Latin America report, you were looking at young Latinos living mostly here in the U.S., and they're creating opportunities to give back to their home country. And you spoke with a few of them. Where did you find this story? Where did you find these people?
Well, a lot of it comes from our pandemic reporting. You and I were just talking about Colombia. Well, that's where one of the most impressive examples of this kind of urge on the part of young expats here to give back to their parents and grandparents' countries is most apparent. You have a young man there who's family fled Cuba in the 1960s and settled in Colombia. And as he's grown up and he sort of grew up between Colombia and South Florida, and now he works in New York, and that he had knee surgery a few months ago and went home to convalesce at his parents' home in Bogota, Colombia, just as the pandemic lockdown was beginning. So he stuck there for a while. So as he told me, his name is Andres Arellano, and he said, with all that idle, you know, downtime I had, I began thinking more about how I've always wanted to help give back to this country that took in my family when they were having a rough time, you know, fleeing Cuba. And he began seeing all of these news reports on TV in Colombia about what you and I were just talking about, lower income people suffering greatly because of the pandemic lockdown and not being able to work. So he got to work creating a new charitable organization called Colombia Sin COVID, or Colombia Without COVID-19, that has done just a remarkable job in just less than 2 months of cobbling together donors and a network of charitable organizations there to deliver food and other necessities to these struggling Colombians. And it's very impressive. But as we say in the report, it's also an example of a trend we're starting to see of younger Latino and Caribbean expats of this generation feeling this collective urge to give back to their families' native countries.
I thought that the interesting part of the story was that I was wondering if it's this generation, this younger generation, that is different in the fact that they want to reach out and do something, but also the fact that, again, in Latin America, if they had grown up in Latin America, maybe they wouldn't have been taught to give, because not a lot of people are taught to give in Latin America.
No, Latin America has one of the lowest rates of charitable giving in the world. I think out of the seven largest economies in Latin America, five are in the bottom 10 when it comes to the levels of charitable giving. It's an unfortunate phenomenon in Latin America. And you make a good point. The fact that, you know, veteran Latino charity organizers here in South Florida tell me that, yes, because these Latino and Caribbean expats have been raised mostly in the U.S. and they've been educated about the importance of philanthropic activity, they are perhaps, you know, the first generation to, you know, as a collective cohort, to say, yes, we need to give back to these countries that our parents came from, and not just to those countries, but also to, you know, people who need it here in the United States.
And you highlight a few of these young folks, and really a good time for it, because we had reported on this before, that the drop in of remittances from South Florida has dropped significantly.
Exactly. Big factor.
I wanted to switch over to just this idea. When I have this conversation with my parents, I always love to hear what are people saying in Colombia, but also throughout Latin America, about what they see happening here in the United States. And now we're going through, you know, these protests and this battle over race. And I wonder what Latin Americans think of that when they see it in the news.
Unfortunately, they see a lot of what they have been living through for centuries. My weekly WLRN commentary last week was just about that. The fact that Latin American expats, let's say, could really be the ones here warning us what can happen in the United States and in any country if you let the kind of police brutality that we saw in the George Floyd case, the kind of racist police brutality that we saw in that case proliferate, because many of them, if not most of them, have lived in countries in Latin America and the Caribbean where they have seen the consequences of the proliferation of that kind of racist police brutality, particularly in countries like Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo, particularly in Mexico. These are countries where people have been fleeing for decades because for many reasons, but one of the largest reasons being police brutality.
I wondered, with the expats living here, with the Latino population in South Florida, how the pandemic, the economic collapse, and now the protests might be shaping what, you know, their views for the upcoming November election.
That is a very good question, because I think one of the dynamics going on here is that even though you do have a lot of Latin American expats who do remember police brutality back in Latin America and the Caribbean, they also value law and order, because that was one of the things that was also missing in the societies that they left in that region. And so there is a large section of the Latin American expat community here who, even if they aren't outright Trump supporters, they do tend to favor that kind of law and order direction that they see the Trump administration taking in an emergency like this. And that, so it's a big question. What will be the factor that sort of tips of eligible voters in this community toward Trump in terms of that law and order impulse, or will they be tipped more toward Joe Biden because of, as you just pointed out, the economic factors and things of that nature that they've been dealing with as well?
Well, you know what, with the pandemic, an economic collapse, and now this, let's not forget, we're 5 months away from an election. So WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. Tim, always a pleasure. Thank you.
You too, Lewis. Thanks.
And by the way, check out his Latin America report this afternoon on All Things Considered. Still to come, social distancing is turning the theater retro. We're going to look at the resurgence of the drive-in movie theater. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Movie theaters remain closed because of the pandemic. Now, theaters in Broward County are set to reopen June 15th, but still not for Miami-Dade or Palm Beach counties. Traditional movie theaters are struggling to survive. CMX Cinemas in Miami-Dade filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The national chain AMC issued a public warning that its finances are in dire conditions. But the pandemic may actually be giving rise to an older American tradition.
Good evening, folks, and a hearty welcome to our drive-in theater. We have a wonderful evening's entertainment lined up for you, one that will provide several hours of pleasurable relaxation and diversion for you and your family.
Drive-ins. These have emerged as the safer alternative. We're joined now by President and CEO of the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival, Gregory Van Hausch. They recently started drive-in movie showings. Gregory, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks a lot. I'm thrilled to be on here, and it's perfect timing for us because we're opening up this Friday at Pier 66 with Bohemian Rhapsody, and it's great timing. I appreciate it.
Oh, what a great choice. Absolutely. Well, also joining us is Daniel Pereira. He's the executive director, or producer, excuse me, of Aver Productions, and partnered up with Deserland Park in North Miami to create Carflix Cinema, a drive-in theater. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Hi, everyone. How are you? Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. Daniel, let me start with you. You started Carflix Cinema recently, again, a drive-in movie experience. Why did you want to do drive-in?
So basically, you know, we, like we said, you know, we are a production company. We do anything from corporate events to social events, everything from LED walls to microphones, speakers, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, we were one day just, you know, talking in the office, and then when this whole pandemic started, and we were like, man, you know, one of our employees was like, man, I wonder what movies are going to happen right now. You know, like, I love going to the movies. They're going to be closed. And then we, like, it kind of, like, struck, like, an idea to say, hey, why don't we just try to bring back a drive-in movie theater? And that's pretty much how it kind of started. And basically, we, you know, we worked with Desertland, and we say, hey, look, you got a piece of land. You know, we have an idea for a drive-in movie theater. Let's partner up. And they were excited about it. And that's how CarFlix Cinema started.
And it uses LED walls to show the films, not the traditional projector. How is that different?
So basically, when you have a projector, you would have to use a really, really high-end lumen projector, you know, to basically be able to project during the day. And we want to kind of maximize the space to maximize the time. So we kind of went with the LED wall, which actually is kind of like watching like a television. And basically, it allows us to have showtime and play movies during the day, starting at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, even starting at 2, even 12 o'clock. So it gives us a more of a opportunity to be able to show more movies just because of the brightness of the actual LED wall.
What kind of feedback have you gotten?
So basically, our guests, every time when people are leaving the shows, we tend to stop a couple of cars and ask them how their experience was. And everybody's been pretty positive. Obviously, some people are like, oh, no, my angle was a little bit to the side, or, you know, the tailgate was a little bit up too high on the other one. But most of it, people are saying that it's a great experience. They love the fact that, you know, they're very into movies. And basically, since they're not able to go to the movie theater, and we don't pretty much know when it's going to open up in Miami-Dade County, but it allows people to kind of still come out, still be around other people, and still be in the safety of their vehicle. But everybody's pretty much loved the idea with the whole driving situation.
And by the way, did you notice is it a younger crowd or an older crowd?
Basically, it's a little bit of a mix of both. It kind of depends on which movie we play. If we play an old movie, like the first movie we start off with was Jurassic Park. And Jurassic Park is a movie that we feel that kind of targets all the ages. So basically, we've had that feedback from everybody, basically, from ages, 50 plus all the way down up to 20 years old.
That's a great choice. Jurassic Park for the big screen. That's a good one. I like that. Gregory, the Fort Lauderdale Film Festival, again, also hosting several drive-in movie nights. When and how did that decision come down to go this route?
Well, when we had to close on March 16th, we started investigating whatever we could do to keep some cash flow and to keep our audience involved throughout the year, because, we always build up for the big film festival, but we have two year-round cinemas with Saver Cinema in Fort Lauderdale and Cinema Paradiso in Hollywood. So we had to come up with some options. So first we did a virtual cinema, which was still going on, and we have about 40 world cinema titles playing on our virtual cinema right now. We also started Press to Play, which is a free service for our members where we'll be streaming free films for them. And we have about 15 to 20, I believe, for our members. But we wanted to recreate that experience you get with a crowd and, having everybody in their homes watching on their sets or computers or whatever just doesn't do it. So we thought, well, the drive-in would be perfect. And we have like a 40-foot screen. We only show at night because we use a regular projector, so we don't have that option to do it during the daytime. But the turnout's been great. We've showed Pulp Fiction and Teen Wolf, and like I said, this weekend we're doing not only Bohemian Rhapsody, but we're doing Bohemian Rhapsody, the sing-along version.
Another good choice. So have the ticket sales for the drive-ins matched up to what you had before?
Yeah, well, I mean, we go nonstop with our theater 7 days a week with matinees all the way into the evening. So we're right currently now is we're just doing films on Friday night. So overall, it won't match up with what we have. But we have been selling them out. Do you plan
on showing films, like from South Florida, independent filmmakers like you normally would for the film festival?
We are right now, we're going to be doing a lot of summer fair blockbuster things like Bohemian, Aquaman, Kingsman, Dirty Dancing, that thing. But during the film festival, we'll be doing not only our what we call celluloid cinema, we'll be doing that, which is local filmmakers. And then throughout the year, we do a thing called Local Filmmaker Night where we provide our theater for free. And then over the summer, we're doing Filmed in Broward for the 9th consecutive year, only opened up to filmmakers who have shot films in Broward County.
And as we mentioned, I mean, Broward County is going to be reopening. Things are going to start reopening. The theater is going to come back. But are you going to keep doing the drive-in screenings?
Yeah, we're definitely going to keep doing the drive-ins, and we're going to make it an element during the film festival as well. We always do a retro pool party night with a film around a pool overlooking the ocean, and we might segue into a retro drive-in night as well.
I love some of the movies you guys have been mentioning, taking me back to my youth. Again, we're talking with Gregory Van Hausch, President and CEO of the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival. Again, they have several drive-in movie showings. And Daniel Pereira, executive producer of Aver Productions, and one of the creators of the drive-in Carflix Cinema in North Miami. You can learn about both. You can just visit our social media at WLRN Sundial. And we'd love to hear from you. Find us on Facebook or Twitter and share with us your drive-in experiences. Maybe the last time you went to a drive-in, your favorite memory of a drive-in. I got to admit, I haven't been to one in a long time. Just to tell you how long, I think the movie I saw was with my folks. It was Jaws. It was Jaws, the original Jaws. So there you go. I wanted to ask both of you about your experiences, your memories of drive-ins. Daniel, let me start with you. Do you have a fond memory of a drive-in experience?
So I don't. I've never really been to a drive-in type of night. This is pretty much the first time. So I'm kind of experiencing it now as I work the event and produce the event. But from what I've been to, you know, being here at Carflix and my whole family has come, it's been a great experience. It's been very memorable. It's something different, something fun, and everybody's really excited. I'm actually really excited to be a part of this and to be able to give back to the community. A lot of people have given, you know, positive reinforcement to what we're doing, and I would imagine that, you know, we can continue this as long as we can.
Yeah, what do you think about that? What do you I mean, you know, because again, eventually everything's going to open back up, but, you know, with the way technology is today, listen, drive-ins were dying out. And in the height of the drive-in experience in America, there were over 4,000 drive-in movie theaters around the country. We're barely at 300 now, and only really like a few dozen are in operation. But, you know, for you, what do you think now that you've had this experience? Do you think this is something that can last?
I think it can. I think it can last. It depends on how, you know, we kind of structure what we're showing, what we're playing, how we keep everybody kind of engaged with the actual experience. I think that now the younger generation now, they love experiences, you know what I mean? So I feel like if we can kind of create some sort of experience as far as like with food trucks or have entertainment out here, maybe have a specific DJ before the showing or maybe a band or something that will keep people engaged. Like, for example, right now, you know, we've been open about for 3 weeks and we've been able to sell out all three weekends except for the last weekend, now the third weekend, which have sales have gone down a little bit just because I would imagine because of the whole protest and the curfew and stuff like that, that we haven't been able to be open certain press amount of time. But what we've noticed is that everybody's pretty much engaged, and we're trying to keep people engaged by, like, since we do have an LED screen, we're going to have, like, you know, small little activities right before the movie starts. Like, we can get maybe, you know, two kids to come up to the front and maybe do like an actual Mario Kart race at the beginning, and then whoever wins actually wins, you know, some popcorn and like stuff like that. We're actually going to have trivia. We have an MC that's going to go around on a microphone and kind of like talk to different people. And if they win the trivia, they answer the question correctly, they'll get another movie ticket for the following week. We're doing a lot of things that really start. Go ahead.
No, do you think the Carflix Cinema at Desertland, is that something you see happen maintaining for a while?
Yeah, I see it maintaining for a little bit, just because a lot of feedback that we have received from people that have come from our clients, they've said that, you know, oh, you know, we know that movie theaters are going to open up, and we know that they're going to, I believe that they said they were actually going to have, like, removed seats in between other seats to give people distance, but people are still going to be a little scared to actually still go to the movie theater, you know, even though they have to go from their car to the actual seat, you know, touching the doorknobs, going yeah. to here, being around other people. So people are actually very comfortable with coming here and being in the comfort and safety of their vehicle.
Definitely.
Which is something that we have really noticed. And I think that we're going to be around for a while. I don't think that maybe, I don't know if we're going to last, you know, more a year or 2 years. That's the plan. We would like to bring some sort of experience like that. But I think that at least for the next couple of months, we will be fine just because of the whole being scared.
Social distancing. It's gonna force us to rethink things. Gregory, first, your fondest memory of drive-in.
Well, I do have a history with drive-ins. I go way back. And I remember back when I was a kid going with my older brother to the drive-ins. This is before they had the carload thing where you paid individually for it. So they would stuff a bunch of the small kids in the trunk and then pull in. And then, of course, my brother, being such a jerk, would leave me locked in there throughout the cartoon. And I'll be pounding on it. We weren't the only ones. You'd see all the trunks popping open as the real feature started. And so that was kind of cool. I remember one time I went with my parents. We saw Blue Denim, which was an extremely sexy movie. And I had to be about, I don't know, 10 years old or so in the back seat. I was so uncomfortable sitting at that movie.
Oh, I can only imagine.
Yeah. But, you know, we, in addition to doing the drive-in, which, by the way, I should say is sponsored by Ed Morris Automotive Group. I want to thank them. And hosted by Pier 66, which is where we're doing it. We also are reopening both of our cinemas on Monday. And to talk about what we've done about it, you know, we'll have all the doors propped open so you don't have to touch anything. We're limiting we seat 250 people in Fort Lauderdale. We're going to limit it to 90 people that can come.
Yeah.
And we've got the shields up. Everybody has to wear a mask. If you don't have a mask when you come in, we'll give you one. Everybody will have their temperature taken at the door. There is distancing within the theater with the seats blocked off.
And you know, I mean, like, because this is part of the new normal, right? But can you make enough doing that? Can you survive on half?
Well, that's a good question. We do want to turn some numbers. We've lost probably around $60,000 since March 16th through rentals, concessions, and of course, ticket sales. It's a challenge, but it's a challenge for the entire nation.
Will you do more showings to try to make up for that?
We're going to try to do is maximize our showings. We're not going to raise prices. We're going to do more incentive things that get people back in the habit to coming to the theater. Like at the drive-in alone, we're giving a free bag of popcorn for every car as they pull in.
Yeah.
Pier 66 will have a concession out there and a bar. So it's, you know, we're doing what we can. We're going to take pictures of everybody that comes in. And the next time they come to the theater, they'll see their picture up on the screen.
You know, I wanted to ask you about this, too, is that the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival is supposed to take place in November. What do we know about? I mean, do you think it's going to run as it usually did, or what's going to change?
Well, I have to play like it's going to run. I'm anticipating it's going to run. I'm being very positive. But when it comes down to it, if this virus reemerges in the fall, we have already taken the initiative to create our own virtual cinema online where we'll be able to show each film as it would play in our theaters during those time slots so people can not only see the films at the appointed hours, but also have Zoom meetings, Q&As with the filmmakers. You know, we don't want to do that, but that's one of the only alternatives we have. So I'm going to stay positive and upbeat, but we're going to listen to the scientists and the doctors. And if it's not safe, we're not going to do it.
Yeah. Daniel, you know, coming back, I just wondered, you know, the big picture, you look at the entertainment industry and this has kind of forced everything to change. Good for Netflix and Hulu, right? Because if you're stuck at home, you can watch a lot of stuff, but people want to get out. You know, what do you think, though, over the next year or two, how the business will change, how we as people will, you know, think about entertainment options differently?
So we've kind of seen a lot of entertainment companies now kind of evolve as far as like the drive-by graduations, the drive-by birthday parties. I don't know if you had a chance to see those on Instagram or on Facebook.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of companies now are emerging and basically – you know, we're going from throwing a party at your house with 100 people to doing a drive-by, you know, putting a float in front of your house with a lot of characters and having a DJ show up and have that kind of like a block party, everybody outside your house, you know, with social distancing. So I feel like the entertainment business is evolving. You know, we're basically right now we're in the talks with, you know, iHeartRadio and stuff like that and Univision and Telemundo and different types of entertainment type of companies that are actually, you know, looking into doing some sort of drive-in concerts, stuff like that, keeping everybody safe, you know, staying with this whole drive-in type concept. And I feel like, you know, now, especially with Zoom and with online web streaming, I think that a lot of events will eventually grow into the actual involvement of having, you know, online, like an online presence. I'm not sure if maybe by next year, hopefully this passes and we can find a vaccine and get everybody back on track. But I see this being around for a while and still being social distant and companies doing everything through like a studio instead of like a hotel. Banquet hall or something like that. I really think that the internet is really helping us out right now to keep people engaged. I know YouTube is doing a lot of concerts via YouTube stream, Facebook, same thing. And people are still able to see, their artists and right. be able to concert.
Yeah. Nope. Listen, YouTube and streaming is keeping me going in a lot of ways. Gregory, let me wrap up with this. The other thing too is that, look, there are a lot of movies that are supposed to be coming out, whether it's the big blockbusters or the independent films. That now gets pushed. The other thing, too, is the production. Productions are getting pushed. Is there a concern that maybe, you know, like later in the fall, going into next year, there will be fewer movies because they couldn't film?
Absolutely. I brought that up to my board at our last board meeting about the scarcity of product. Because so many things just never got going or never got into post-production with the bigger films, never got in distribution. So it's a problem for us, obviously. It's a major problem for the industry as a whole, because most people aren't movie stars or Steven Spielberg.
Right.
90% of the people are working people that depend on their paycheck for their livelihood. And that's exceptionally true in Florida, more and more as a location state.
Yeah, a lot's changing. It's a little bit scary. It really is. But you know what? We're going to get through this. Again, Gregory Von Hausch, president, CEO of the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival. Daniel Pereira, executive producer of Aver Productions. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And again, you can learn more about drive-in experiences on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Coming up tomorrow on the program, our conversation with Fort Lauderdale Mayor Dean Trantalis. We're going to talk about the protests and more. If you have a question for the mayor, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial or email us sundial@wlrnnews.org. And we'll get your questions into the mayor tomorrow. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much. Stay safe. We'll talk to you again live tomorrow.